Moderator for Report on Integration is CBS News Washington correspondent Griffin Bancroft.
Well, the headlines in the news about school integration in the South right now are all in Little Rock, Arkansas. But in addition, there is still the broader question. Just what progress has integration made in the South since the Supreme Court outlawed separate schools in its decision of May 17, 1954? What is the background of Little Rock, and what will be its effect on the future? What is the situation in the South today? The four newsmen with us here today are members of a group that started soon after the Supreme Court decision to report to the people of the southern and border states on the status of integration. They are members of the Southern Education Reporting Service, an organization of southern newspaper editors and educators who are dedicated to the idea that there is a vital need for objective and nonpartisan reporting in this field. It is in this nonpartisan vineyard that our guests have labored. So Mr. Shoemaker, as executive director of the Southern Education Reporting Service, suppose we start with you and ask you to give us a general picture of just what is the status of integration in the South today.
Yes, Mr. Bancroft, let me give it to you very briefly. There is a considerable amount of desegregation in the border states, the upper tier of states. There is a lesser amount in the states of the Mid-South, in fact, a very small amount, and pretty solid segregation in the Deep South. There are 745 school districts which have desegregated since 1954 out of about 3,000 that are biracial.
Well, before we go any farther, Mr. Shoemaker, I wonder if I could ask you to explain briefly just what your organization is and how it works and how you get this information.
Yes, Southern Education Reporting Service was set up in 1954, as you said, to trace developments in this field. We get our information through a corps of correspondents, of whom these three gentlemen are members, and we publish Southern School News, and we have just preparing to bring out this book with all deliberate speed, which summarizes the developments in this field in the 3 years since the Supreme Court
and
decision.
And these newsmen here, I know they have each contributed a chapter to this book, and they are part of your staff, in effect.
Yes,
is that correct?
Yes, each one of them has contributed among 11 contributors.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Mr. James has written one of the opening chapters, which deals in large part with the situation in the border states. And if you'd like, we might begin at that point.
I think that's fine.
Walden James?
Mr. James.
A general summary.
Well, as Mr. Shoemaker was saying, in the border states, there's been a much higher degree of compliance with the court's decree. I think it'd be worthwhile to limit ourselves briefly to a look at what happened in Kentucky, which regards itself as a southern state, but which has not followed the Deep South pattern. The moment the Supreme Court ruled in 1954, the governor of Kentucky, at that time Governor Weatherby, said immediately that Kentucky will do whatever is necessary to comply with the law. The Republican senator, the only one at that time, Senator John Sherman Cooper, said just about the same thing. And then various state officials and school superintendents like Mr. Carmichael in Louisville all sort of got onto the general compliance theme and said it was more or less inevitable, let's face it, and get on with it. In the 3 years since then, we've had no integration the first year because of local legal rulings as far as state law were concerned until the Supreme Court's implementation ruling in 1955. Immediately that year, several districts desegregated. In the past 2 years, including the opening of school this month, you now have 105 districts in Kentucky desegregated out of 217. But in those 105 districts, you have 80% of the Negro school-age pupils of the state.
That is pretty well the border pattern, with the possible exception of Delaware, and then quite the other side of it, West Virginia, I believe, since the opening of schools this year, is the first state to have 100% desegregation in its counties.
Yes. Well, mind you, I think we couldn't leave the border states without pointing out that they have had their troubles, as all readers of newspaper headlines know. The city of Louisville had remarkably little or none at a time when other cities or towns in Kentucky were, having the National Guard called out and state troopers sent in a year ago.
Well, now, what about the Deep South? Mr. Workman, you're stationed in that area. That is your bailiwick, is it? What is the status of things there?
Yes, Mr. Bancroft, and the story with respect to the Deep South is completely different from that Mr. James has just described. With all deliberate speed in those 8 states with which I'm most concerned, at least in this book, has been that the deliberate speed has been in almost every instance in the opposite direction, that is, towards strengthening segregation and maintaining the separate schools which have existed through the years. Now, there's been recently, and in fact, the only crack that has been made in that solid wall of resistance has come this year, beginning of this school year, in North Carolina, with the admission of Negroes to schools on a very limited basis and after screening in the towns of Charlotte, Raleigh, and Winston-Salem. That was done with the...
Bill Greensboro, yes. Instead of Raleigh.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes Greensboro. But the fact of the matter is that in each of these instances, it was done by the action of the local school board in accord with the North Carolina pupil placement law, which, as I said, makes for screening and admission of selected Negro students to these white schools. But other than for that, if you take the huge crescent that we call the Deep South, and that sweeps from Virginia through North and South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, with Florida thrown in, the resistance there has been, to use a Virginia term, massive. And there is now, with the exception of the 3 North Carolina communities I mentioned, there has not been admitted any Negro student to any white school in that entire area in the 3 years since the decision.
Well, now, Mr. Parham over here, as I understand it, your bailiwick has been more or less in the field of higher education and integration in the colleges in the South. So what can you report about that?
Yes, it has, Mr. Bancroft, and as you are doubtless aware, the situation is most tense in the southeastern corner of the nation. Now, there has been no segregation in higher education in Georgia, South Carolina, Mississippi, or Florida, and except for a stormy 3 days during the Authorine Lucy case, there has been none in Alabama. Desegregation has proceeded at a rapid pace in Arkansas, that is in higher education. In Arkansas, Delaware, Kentucky, Missouri, Maryland, Oklahoma, and West Virginia. It's moved slowly and haltingly in Louisiana, North Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, and Virginia. I might say that in the District of Columbia and the 12 states of the South having complete or partial desegregation in public higher education. 115 of 149 tax-supported former white schools now accept qualified Negro students, and it's estimated that about 2,400 Negroes are attending these schools. But there are 53 public white colleges in the 5 states that I mentioned in the southeastern corner of the nation that have no desegregation whatsoever in higher education. The Supreme Court decision now of 1954 accelerated the desegregation process in the border states or the states which are haltingly complying with the law, but private and non-Catholic church schools have been reluctant to follow in the South.
Well, it seems to me it should be made clear that this integration in the colleges of which you were speaking really started long before the 1954 Supreme Court decision, did it not? It started under the separate but equal clause.
It certainly did. The first instance was at the University of Arkansas in 1948 when the state agreed to integrate, not because they were under court order, but because the state realized the economic limitations of refusing to integrate at that time.
That was the only voluntary integration.
Yes, it was.
Well, you had the example of the University of Louisville, of course, which became the first school south of the Mason and Dixon line to admit Negroes without court action to its undergraduate schools back in 1950. And there again, you had 6 years of experience, 5 years fully of experience in the higher reaches of education before the public schools attempted it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder if we could get this back to the headlines for just a minute, and that is, there seems to be a question as to the effect of events in Little Rock on the rest of the South and the border areas, and I'd like very much to know what you gentlemen think the effects of use of federal troops and of mob violence in Little Rock, whether it is going to hasten or further delay integration or whatnot. Mr. Shoemaker, what do you think about that?
Well, let me interject a little something here. We don't think. We are an impartial reporting service that does not reflect opinion.
Well, then what can you report about
that? Well, we can report what has happened and what people say. And perhaps we might go to Mr. Parham here for some reflection of what people are saying in his section of the country.
I don't think there's any question, Mr. Bancroft, but there is a good deal of deep-seated bitterness at the president's action from my section in Georgia. Not only public officials feel that way, but also a lot of people feel that way. The reaction that I have had from people there is that Mr. Eisenhower has somewhat become an extremist. He has dropped the moderate course himself in that he has used the ultimate weapon, the last resort of taking federal troops in to force integration.
Well, then this means that that you believe or you can report that resistance to integration will stiffen as a result of what has happened?
I had thought that resistance to integration was about as hard as it could get, but I would say that it's even harder after the president's action, no question.
Well, now, what about the border states?
You might be able to guess at the rest of the history of the border states, I can give you, I've taken no public opinion poll in Kentucky, but the governor of the state, Governor Chandler, endorsed what the president did. He said the president did what he had to. Two or three of the larger newspapers in the state have said almost exactly that, that Mr. Eisenhower acted at the last minute and did what he had to if the law were to be upheld. I talked only yesterday with a gentleman in western Kentucky who feels that the president did considerably more than he had to, and that it is a black and hopeless future for local self-rule, states' rights, etc. But that point of view apparently so far has been in the minority in Kentucky.
Well, then, would it be fair to say that you believe the opinion of your people in your area would be that this would perhaps hasten integration?
I've talked with several school people in Kentucky who do believe that, yes. That it greatly adds to the doctrine of inevitability.
Mm-hmm. excuse me.
Yes, from South Carolina now.
I can speak not only in the terms of a reporter from South Carolina, but also having been at the Southern Governors Conference at Sea Island, Georgia, when this action was taken by the president, and having talked with the governors who were there represented, I can say that at least so far, as the Democratic governors of the states of the Deep South, that there was almost universal condemnation in varying degrees of bitterness over the president's action. And I know that subsequent to that, in my own state of South Carolina, that resentment and genuine concern has been reflected from top to bottom in letters to the editor, in comments of people on the streets, and well, I might just cite this particular example that Governor George Bell Timmerman, Jr., who has been officer of the Naval Reserve, has only now resigned his commission in protest against the change in federal policy with respect to what he calls the rights and the privileges of an American citizen. So within the states of the Deep South, those represented the Southern Governors Conference, there was considerable apprehension and resentment. And a number of people have, to me, indicated the fact that the problem now has moved out of the field of integration or desegregation and into the field of fundamental governmental principles, and a lot of them are concerned more than they were before. One schoolman said, when I called him for a quote day before yesterday, that he has the uneasy feeling that those bayonets are pointing at him and at everybody else.
But doesn't this reaction kind of follow the pattern that has occurred in this desegregation process? I mean, in the border states down to the Mid-South, you'd find a little less reaction, perhaps, except for Arkansas.
Right.
Down to the Deep South. It's a general pattern, a historic pattern all the way.
I think you might note this, that there has been desegregation has been affected in the college field more than any other. But that, and this has not been followed necessarily by the regional bloodletting or the unrestrained violence which a lot of people predicted would take place. But it must be noted that in the only instance in which a Negro entered a white university in one of the Deep South states where opposition to integration is most firm, that stark violence erupted. And a woman came very close to losing her life. This was the Authorine Lucy case at the University of Alabama. Tuscaloosa. Mm-hmm.
Well, isn't it true, and I want to ask Mr. Parham if he'll not agree with me, that what's reflected here is the willingness or unwillingness of the community to accept a change in its school establishment. Now, that the Alabama community was completely unwilling to accept Negroes into the University of Alabama. By contrast, we have the three North Carolina cities, which are showing some degree of willingness to accept at least some Negroes in their pupil placement thing. And I think Mr. Shoemaker is correct when we say that the reaction to the Arkansas developments simply accentuates the general prevailing sentiment in South Carolina, in Georgia, or wherever it might be, which prevailed prior to these things.
Well, that's an interesting field of speculation. I'd like to interject that, yes, in the view of the school administrators in Louisville, they didn't believe that a majority of the white people there approved of the change, but they thought that they had to comply with the law, and so stated without taking sides on the desirability or undesirability of it. And elsewhere in the border states, including in Kentucky, when there was disturbance or violence at any newly integrated school, either the National Guard or state troops were called up to protect the rights of Negro students to go to those schools, usually under court order. You haven't had that exercise of state power elsewhere.
Well, didn't you have, though, in Louisville, didn't you have a good bit of the leading citizens of the community, the newspapers and others of influence, urging that desegregation be accepted in Louisville?
Yes, you had a two-year program of education of the public, so-called, in which every minister, priest, and rabbi was asked by the school authorities to lend a hand and preach either on the brotherhood of man or on the necessity of complying with the law.
Well, Mr. James, you're the author of a book on that, are you not? The Louisville story?
Well, yes, and I hastily want to add that Dr. Omar Carmichael was the co-author of that book, the school superintendent.
Well, now, in Louisville, it is more than token integration, in your opinion. I mean, there real integration has taken place?
I would say a considerable amount of integration. Mm-hmm. We have about 75 public schools, and I think there are about 19 of them, perhaps, that this year. A dozen that remain all white and 9 that remain all Negro. The rest all have mixed groups of students. And you have the free choice system there. We've had this year an occasional transfer back to all Negro schools on the part of some of the students.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of a trend is coming out of that? Well, the newspapers will have to tell in future. But in the Louisville setup, of course, I think it's worth pointing out in the question that Joe raised, that Mr. Parham raised, that this use of the ministerial, the priests and the rabbis and so on, along with civic leaders, was one thing. But several years ago, the Louisville Presbyterian Seminary, which educates a great many ministers for the South, and the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, both of them desegregated. And they have had desegregated student bodies for the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, you got a great deal of preparation in Little Rock, too, for that matter.
Yes.
Well, I wonder, Mr. Shoemaker, you're the editor here. We have a pretty good explanation now of how this thing was worked in a border state area like Louisville. I wonder if someone would undertake to tell us briefly why the same steps would not work in a Deep South community. I'm sure there are a lot of apparent reasons, but maybe we could lay them out.
Yeah. As long as it doesn't get us into opinion, we can. perhaps Bill Workman would make some of the points here that are most often raised in his area of the country, that is, South Carolina and the Deep South in general.
Well, attempting to speak in as much of a vacuum as possible and simply reflecting what's actually been done,
yes,
in South Carolina and the Deep South, I might start by saying that there is a prevailing attitude there and a set of circumstances which is at variance with that in the border states. In the first place, these states of the Deep South with which I'm referring are states that have a close connection with the late lamented Confederacy. And there, no matter, or rather despite the fact that the doctrine of states' rights now seems to have lost some of its usefulness throughout the nation, there is still a deep-seated belief that states do have certain prerogatives and rights to do in the field of public education in the exercise of their police powers, among other powers which are not delegated to the federal government. So there's that genuine philosophical belief. There is perhaps equally important the question of numbers, because in these states, the ratio of Negroes runs from 22% to 45%. And in hundreds of the Deep South communities, School integration would not mean the admission of a few Negroes to a white school, but the admission of, or the forcing of a few white students into what would be essentially a Negro school. To cite the example of our case which went to the Supreme Court from Clarendon County, if that school district had been integrated when the order came down initially, that would have meant that three white pupils would have been put in with 27 Negro pupils.
That's Clarendon County,
South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Now, that can be duplicated elsewhere.
That would be true in a lot of rural areas throughout the South, wouldn't it?
Yes, because what you have here, these numbers follow the general pattern of the slave culture back in the pre-war days, and I'm speaking now of the War of Northern Aggression, as it's sometimes referred to.
But no opinions on this program, Mr.
I'm Newman. Quoting. But the fact of the matter is that we have, throughout this area of the country, a considerable stronger body of legislation at the moment than existed prior to the Supreme Court decision, as state after state has adopted legislation which is of, frankly, dubious validity in some instances, and some of the authors themselves will admit as much. But nevertheless, in an effort to stave off integration, whether it be for a few years or whether it be, as some have said, for 1,000 years, time alone will tell, but nevertheless, there has been this determined effort to enact laws which will stave it off, give breathing period or give more legal recourse to put aside the possible advent of desegregation. And that picture is pretty solid throughout all the states of the Deep South, including North Carolina.
About 140 pieces of legislation, I think, in the last 3 years, 4 years, something like that.
That's right, yes.
Could we just ask him some of the typical things they're dealing with?
Yes, I wish you would.
I think, Mr. Shoemaker, that this will... Excuse me.
Yes, well, you go ahead.
The types of legislation, and some of them are astounding in their content and in their, although they all aim at the same general purpose, they fall generally into these three categories. First of all, there's the pupil placement authority, which vests school boards with considerable power to apportion pupils to control transfers so long as they meet certain standards, and they are careful in most instances to avoid the use of race as a criteria.
But in Virginia, they made that a centralized state function, didn't they, instead of leaving it up to the local school board?
Well, there has been that distinction, that some instances is exercised by the state or state board and others by the local. Now, as a second device which is being used, and this fits a great bit of legislation, notably in South Carolina and Georgia, arrangements have been made by legislation for the automatic shutting off of all funds for the support of schools if those schools are to be integrated by court order. Mm-hmm. And in South Carolina, the further development is that not only is the funds shut off to the integrated white school, but they also shut off for the Negro school from which the pupil is transferred. And then there's a third category, which we might say is the exercise of police powers, in which they have sought simply to say that for the peace and domestic tranquility of the state, that the state does have authority to lay down certain regulations and restrictions as to the mingling of races.
Well, now, that report from South Carolina, and you mentioned something a few years or 1,000 years, and there's quite a lot of difference. I wonder if we could try to take a look into the future as to what is going to happen. Now, integration in the Deep South ever going to be accepted? If so, is it a matter of a few years or 1,000 years?
Let me make two generalizations, if I may.
Yes.
First, as this, this book, With All Deliberate Speed, brings out, the South is a land of paradoxes. Almost every school district differs, a different situation, just as individuals differ. For instance, there are about 200 districts in the border states that are just as tightly segregated as any in the Deep South. It is often said that it's easier to integrate where there are fewer Negroes, and yet you had an outburst at Clay, Kentucky. On the other hand, Washington, D.C., with 70% Negro school population. Those are just two of the background aspects of the situation. As to the future, perhaps some of these gentlemen can...
Oh, of course.
Well, now...
everybody wants to talk.
Well, Mr. Parham of the Macon, Georgia News, what about that?
Well, I might point out that even before the Little Rock incidents, that the people of Georgia had voted to do away with, to abolish the public schools, before accepting integration of the races. That is a pretty drastic step, of course, and I'm sure that the people who voted for that considered it before they did so. As to what is going to happen in the future, I don't know. I will say that I do not believe that there is any community in Georgia, anyway, which would accept integration at this time.
You don't think it will ever come. Well, now, Mr. Workman of the Charleston News and Courier, what about you? Do you think it's ever going to come?
Quoting from our political and educational leaders in South Carolina, they have estimated the coming time of integration is anywhere from 1,000 years on. Now that, I think, would govern the plans that is now being drawn.
Well, to come to the border areas, Mr. James of the Louisville Courier Journal.
Well, a good many newspaper editorials that I've read in border state papers and some of the school people I've talked with have a somewhat more optimistic view. I report in this book here, sir,
yes,
a belief in the Deep South that it may be a 30 years war, as Mr. Workman says. Some people might say it's 1,000 years. But a lot of people in the border states believe that with the successive integration of a few more districts here and there, on the gradual program allowed by the Supreme Court, that within, say, 10 to 20 years, you may have a fair degree of at least token integration and compliance with the court's order throughout the South.
Well, Mr. Shoemaker, you, as the executive editor, sit here and get all these reports. How would you answer that question? How's your crystal ball of what is going to happen?
Well, that's a department that we don't include in our operation. As I mentioned a little while ago, it's different from area to area. There are these paradoxes, and there's a kind of historic pattern to this whole business that goes back three generations in the acceptance of this idea of mixed schooling. It's inescapable from all the facts that are assembled.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, the border states, a little bit in the Mid-South and then in the Deep South, retaining school segregation. Whether that can be projected, I don't know, but that's the general status.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have, and this has been a very instructive program, and I want to thank you gentlemen very much for joining us today in this report on integration.
From Washington, CBS Television has brought you a special report on integration by staff members of the Southern Education Reporting Service, a nonpartisan organization which aims to report factually and objectively on school integration developments in southern and border states. Our guests today were Weldon James, associate editor of the Louisville Courier Journal, Joseph Parham, editor of the Macon, Georgia News, Don Shoemaker, executive director of the Southern Education Reporting Service and editor of the Southern School News, and W.D. Workman, Jr., correspondent for the Charleston News and Courier and the Greenville News. They reported in a special report on integration. Griffin Bancroft, CBS News Washington correspondent, was moderator. This program was produced by Bill Coben. This has been a special CBS Public Affairs program.